and welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs, the Daily Nonpareil, on this Monday, July 19th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. We're reading from the Sunday edition of the newspaper. On the front page, we have a Tim Johnson story. Sign up begins soon for AIM Institute Southwest Iowa Tech Training Initiative. Applications will soon be accepted for the AIM Institute Southwest Iowa Tech Training Initiative funded by the Charles E. Lakin Foundation. Classes will begin in late August or September and will be ongoing, so students will be able to start at various times during the year, according to Emily Mattis, Director of Tech Education and Tech Navigator at the AIM Institute. Deadlines will be 1 week before each class starts. She said via email, "I will be informing them of their participation in the course after they sign up." The program targets low to moderate income young adults ages 16 to 24, workers dislocated by COVID-19, and other at-risk populations in Southwest Iowa. It will be funded by a five-year, $500,000 grant from the Lakin Foundation. In Iowa, science, technology, engineering, and math jobs are growing twice as fast as non-STEM jobs, but there is a shortage of qualified tech workers. The students will be taking existing AIM AIM classes, the Introduction to Technology course, but in separate cohorts for this particular program so they can learn and grow together as a group, Mattis said. This class is specifically designed to prepare students for further tech education, as well as to give them some basic tech skills that would prepare them for a support-type position. The class, which will total more than 40 hours of instruction time, will help students build foundational skills in coding, design, data, infrastructure, and management. It will include projects that will allow students to begin building a portfolio they can share with potential employers and give them an opportunity to earn a certificate. In the metro area, the two largest areas which we are seeing demand are coding and data, Mattis said. However, we are facing a shortage of local tech workers in all of the areas which we are targeting at this course. AIM Institute experts will bring the training to the students through Southwest Iowa training sites and online instruction, Mattis said. We will offer a variety of in-person and virtual options for the classes, depending on where the students are located, with some courses taking place in Council Bluffs and the surrounding area, and the rest offered online, she said. Students will be assisted by navigators from the AIM Institute who will divide their time between the Southwest Iowa program and AIM's Code School, Mattis said. We plan to hire a few more, provided we have enough participants to warrant it, she said. I also will be working to help students as well in my capacity as Code School Director. The program is intended to help 100 individuals annually over the five-year period. The goal is to recruit 70 students each year from Pottawatomie County, 11 from Mills County, 11 from Harrison County, and 8 from Montgomery County. Those interested can sign up at aimcodeschool.org/workshops. Once the program is added, for more information about AIM, see aiminstitute.org. Another story on the front page, Bluffs Bridge Club returns to YMCA Healthy Living Center. It's reported by Emily Scheib. It's time to get in the game of bridge with Bluffs Bridge Club in Council Bluffs after a 15-month hiatus. Card game enthusiasts can learn the game or sharpen their skills under the direction of American Contract Bridge League instructor and Bluffs Bridge director Pierre Flatowitz. Founded in September 2019 by Dr. Ted Hoff and Dick Miller, Bluffs Bridge Club meets for duplicate and social bridge at the YMCA Healthy Living Center 714 South Main Street. Duplicate bridge on Thursdays at 11:30 a.m. with a complimentary lesson starting at 10:45 is $8 per session, and the game is more complex. Social bridge is on Fridays from 9 a.m. to noon and is $3 per session. Social bridge is more laid back and is more for beginners. This is focused for players who are taking beginner classes. We go over the games that people play on Thursday, said Dr. James Rochelle, manager of the Bluffs Bridge Club. This way we can walk people through games until they feel comfortable to play in Thursday classes. When the games start on Friday, all four players place their cards on the table and Hoff and Rochelle will walk players through the game. We go over all the aspects of bridge and explain why we did what we did, Hoff said. We take all the mechanical knowledge that they don't have and we put that on the table for them to see. Since resuming sessions, Bluffs Bridge Club has been averaging 6 tables, which equals out to 24 players. Flatowicz said that even clubs in Omaha have smaller groups some days. We are slowly growing, and yet to have 6 tables is excellent, he said. Flatowicz is also the co-owner and director of House of Cards in Omaha, Nebraska, and has been playing bridge for more than 50 years. He has played in high-level bridge tournaments all over the United States and internationally. Bridge is a game of partnership and communication, and Flatowicz described it as a happy marriage. It's an atmosphere where players can come, have fun, and not have to worry about memorizing how to score because we have bridge mates, he said. Bridge mates are wireless scoring system for bridge games that look like calculators. When the games are over, players are given an answer sheet so they can see what they've done. But sometimes players do better than what the answer sheet says, Flatowicz said. No matter how many years of experience someone has, Flatowicz says, the knowledge of bridge is endless. Some people have been playing for 30 to 40 years, but they learned from playing with friends growing up, and some have never had formal lessons, he said. When the game is over, Flatowicz will work with players who may have questions or want advice. I love the game of bridge. I think it's a phenomenal game, Flatowicz said. I enjoy working with people to help them improve their game of bridge. Those who are new to bridge or would like to freshen their knowledge about the game can sign up for bridge lessons beginning on September 7. Lessons will be on Tuesdays from 9 to 11 a.m. for 8 weeks and are free for new players and $40 for players who have taken the lessons before. People learning today have a huge advantage over those who learned 50 to 60 years ago because there was limited knowledge about the game, Flatowicz said. Today, they've invented so many tools and scientific bidding theories that help people learn the game better than before. After finishing the beginning classes, it's recommended players take intermediate bridge classes and then actually play the game. You have to practice and play, because if you just take lessons and don't practice, you'll forget everything you learn, Flatowicz said. You improve by playing the game. Even though bridge is a partner game, don't feel discouraged if you don't have a partner. Those who don't have partners but would like to play should mention that they are looking for a partner when they sign up. Players don't need to be a member of the YMCA to join. It's a very loose an enjoyable atmosphere, Flatowicz said. Everyone has fun whether they win or lose. Those interested in joining can contact Rochelle at 402-201-3264. The article is accompanied by 2 front page color pictures, one of which is a table of 4 people playing their bridge cards, and in the middle we can see that calculator-like device which keeps score automatically for them, and a second picture of the director of the bridge classes, Director Peter Flatowicz. He's wearing a purple polo shirt and he's standing before a whiteboard which is marked with what looks like bridge card hand dealt configurations. And a third story on the front page, courthouse project results in opening of time capsule, reported by Tim Johnson. 2076 came a little early in Council Bluffs. A time capsule that was to be opened in that year was cracked open Tuesday when construction workers dug it up to make way for the basement of a Pottawatomie County Courthouse addition. The container, roughly 2 feet by 4 feet, held documents, newspapers, books, and other items of local and or national significance. The existence of the time capsule was noted on a bronze plaque mounted on a granite marker on the courthouse lawn, but there were no instructions on where to find it, according to Jason Slack, Director of Buildings and Grounds for Pottawatomie County. If you knocked on the bronze plate, it sounded hollow, so we thought that was the capsule, he said. The crew took the granite marker with the plaque to the Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office for safekeeping, Slack said. When that turned out not to be the capsule, they started digging where the marker had been. It wasn't until they got 9 or 10 feet down that they struck the capsule. The backhoe took a chunk out of the corner of it, he said. The capsule was enclosed in a concrete burial vault, Slack said. It looked like it had been sealed, but water had seeped into it sometime, he said. Everything in there was soaking wet. The contents were taken to a county shed where they were spread out on tables to dry, Slack said. He met with several people from the Historical Society of Pottawatomie County who looked over the materials. I know this was an accident, but I think it was a lucky accident, said Dick Warner of the Historical Society. There were some things that were pretty well shot. Another few decades and there might not have been much left. He said the building and grounds crew had done the right thing by letting things dry and calling the Historical Society. The time capsule had been buried on July 4, 1977, the end of the U.S. bicentennial, and was to be opened on July 4, 2076, the nation's 300th birthday. Local leaders had collected bicentennial memorabilia, other items of national significance, and information on the community to include the snapshot of life in the 1970s. I was quite impressed with the breadth of the collection and the size of the collection that was in there, Warner said. Whoever put it together did an incredible job of getting representations of local organizations. Bicentennial items included a banner, large copies of the U.S. Declaration of Independence and Constitution, a bicentennial message from President Gerald Ford, commemorative medallions, and numerous newspaper articles. There was an information packet on the inauguration of President Jimmy Carter on January 20, 1977. Most of the contents were related to the local community. There was a proclamation signed by then-Mayor Daniel E. Lewis, a map of Council Bluffs, yearbooks from local high schools, a St. Albert Catholic School student and parent handbook, an Iowa Western Community College catalog, a copy of the Council Bluffs Community School District 1975-76 annual report, information on the design for the Iowa Powers Council Bluffs Power Station Unit 3, and area newspapers with articles on local developments, such as construction of Midlands Mall and completion of the courthouse itself. There were also materials submitted by local businesses and organizations, such as advertising materials from local or Colt car dealers, and information on club activities, including fundraising for the JC's fireworks display. They reached out to over 100 organizations in the area, Slack said. Other contents include the following: men's and women's clothing, a water sample from Council Bluffs Waterworks, for future scientists to analyze. 2 toy tractors, new unopened cassette tapes of popular music, a Sears catalog. At some point, the Pottawatomie County Board of Supervisors will have to decide whether to try to seal everything in a different container and bury them again, or preserve them above ground and perhaps display some items. Slack met with several people from the Historical Society of Pottawatomie County to get advice on preserving the artifacts. He also plans to contact officials at the Durham Museum in Omaha. Once we get some information from the conservators about how to preserve things, we'll at least have some suggestions for the board, he said. And there is a nice color picture on the front page of Jason Slack, director of the Buildings and Grounds for Pottawatomie County, as he reads the results of the water sample test from Council Bluffs Waterworks while going through items contained in an unearthed time capsule found under the county courthouse on Tuesday. The picture shows him standing amidst an array of spread out items drying out. Those items, as mentioned in the article, had been soaked by water leaking into the vault. And still on the front page, we have a story reported by Aaron Murphy, Andrew Wind, and Anthony Watt of the Lee Des Moines Bureau, Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier, and the Quad City Times. Headline, hundreds of students apply for open enrollment under new state law. A new state law that bars schools from denying students from enrolling in other public districts in order to maintain demographic diversity is already having a significant impact on some Iowa districts with large minority populations. Almost 140 students, almost double what the state's legislative analysis agency projected, have requested to open enroll out of the Waterloo Community School District. School officials said Waterloo has one of the Iowa's highest minority populations. In Des Moines, nearly 300 students applied for open enrollment before the March 1st deadline, and another 95 have applied since the law was changed, school officials said. And in Davenport, more than 100 students have applied for open enrollment, all but 9 of them under the new state law, school officials said. Those numbers will be celebrated by supporters of the new state law, which they said was necessary to allow all students more choice in which school they attend, and they will be highlighted by the law. New law's critics, who will note the enrollment changes, will leave behind higher concentrations of students with heightened learning needs and from low-income backgrounds. Before the new law, 5 Iowa school districts had diversity plans that enabled them to reject requests for open enrollment to other public schools if that student leaving the district would create issues with the district's student diversity. Five Iowa districts had diversity plans in Davenport, Waterloo, Des Moines, West Liberty, and Postville. The law, approved earlier this year by the Republican-led Iowa legislature and signed into law by Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, banned those diversity plans. Hundreds of families across Iowa are already taking advantage of the new law, and far more than expected in some districts. As of Thursday, the Davenport Community School District had 219 applications to transfer to another district for the 2021-2022 school year, 117 of which were for family preference, school leaders said. Had the voluntary diversity plan still been in place, only 9 of those transfers would have been approved unless families chose to pay tuition, officials said. The district is also attempting to contact the families of another 29 students that applied but had their request to transfer denied under the diversity plan. These applications are being retroactively approved unless a family changes its mind. School officials, however, expect the majority of those families to send their children to another district. Another 73 applications are classified as continuing enrollments, which means the families are moving to Davenport but want their students to continue their education in their former district. The district said this was higher than expected and could indicate decision making based on the real or perceived reputation of the Davenport schools. Of the 131 transfer requests for which the district has demographic information available, 70% were white students and just 8% were black, according to school data. The district student body is 53% white and 20% black. Davenport Superintendent T.J. Schneckloth said the new law is what it is. He said the district is attempting to offset the transfer's impact by highlighting the education services and opportunities for students to succeed that it offers. What we're going to do is we're going to make Davenport the destination of choice, Schneckloth said. The only thing that we can do is move forward and make Davenport the place to be, and that's what we intend to do. Schneckloth said the transfers could also create financial issues for the district, which budgets for an expected enrollment figure and could wind up with a significantly different number. He said he could not provide a dollar amount for the financial impact of the transfers or forecast what the final enrollment number will be, but that the district will need to be able to somehow forecast that impact in the future. If you can anticipate what the enrollment is the enrollment in and the enrollment out is, it's much easier to budget for. And so, in the upcoming years, we're going to be monitoring that very closely, Schneckloth said. The end of voluntary diversity plans in Iowa has led to larger exodus of students from Waterloo Community Schools than was initially predicted. The Legislative Services Agency estimated this spring that 75 students would request to open enroll out of the district this fall if the law was changed. However, since Reynolds signed the bill into law in May, 136 requests to open enroll out of Waterloo schools have been made, according to the district. And because the legislation includes no application deadline for the coming year in the five school districts that had plans, those requests could keep coming. Superintendent Jane Lindemann said she has met with Reynolds about the concern. They didn't intend it to be an open-ended date, she said. I've talked with them three separate times about it, and they definitely monitored the impact. Typically, the deadline is March 1 to apply for open enrollment, but the bill banning diversity plans extended that for the affected districts. Waterloo School's diversity plan required equal numbers of students from a similar family income level to open enroll in and out for a request to be approved. That made it more difficult to leave or enter its school compared with surrounding districts. As of Wednesday, 12 different school districts were represented in the request to open enroll out of Waterloo schools. District officials said 89% of the 136 students are white. By level, 87 of the requests are at the elementaries, 21 in the middle schools, and 28 at the high schools. It's definitely skewed toward our littlest learners, said Lindemann, noting the district's open enrollment requests are generally weighted toward early elementary grades. Proportionally, it's very heavily skewed toward our kindergarten class. That can be seen in the 29 Waterloo schools open enrollment out in requests accepted Monday by Cedar Falls Community Schools Board of Education. 9 requests were for kindergartners, 5 for first graders, 4 for fourth graders, 1 for 3 requests were made for students in the other elementary grades, along with 3 sophomores and 1 senior. The Cedar Falls Board denied 15 other requests to open enroll in from Waterloo schools. All but 2 were for students going into 7th through 9th grades. Cedar Falls Superintendent Andy Petty said those denials related to capacity limits at the district's two junior high schools. The other two at Cedar Falls High School were denied due to program needs. Along with those 44, Waterloo School's officials said they have received four other open enrollment out requests to Cedar Falls, and seven of the total are for the district's virtual learning program. Officials from other districts said they have so far accepted all the requests received for open enrollment out of Waterloo schools. Before getting confirmation from Cedar Falls schools, Waterloo administrators said 79 of the requests to open enroll out had been approved by the other districts, while six had been canceled. Along with the Cedar Falls denials, seven requests to open enroll into the Waterloo schools have softened the impact on the district. Originally, there was another open enrollment in request that was canceled by the parent. Six of the remaining requests have been approved, with administrators still working on the final one. Waterloo schools officials said the second highest number of requests to open enroll out was to Hudson Community Schools at 29. Hudson Superintendent Tony Voss said the district school board has approved 28 requests, with at least three more on the agenda for this week's meeting. "We've got capacity right now, so we're not turning anybody away at this point," said Voss. "We're wondering if there's going to be another run before school starts. That wouldn't be particularly surprising if that does happen." He was uncertain if the district would be able to take more open enrollments after the school year started. "I'm sure we'll take it on a case-by-case basis," Voss said. And now it's time to turn to the opinion page. We have a column by Aaron Murphy of the Lee Des Moines Bureau. "Dangerous time to roll back public reporting of COVID-19 data. The last mile of a marathon is no time to slow down. Yet that is, in effect, what the state of Iowa has chosen to do in its reporting of COVID-19 data. The state's public health department recently notified local officials that the state, over recent and coming weeks, has and will update COVID-19 data on the state's coronavirus.iowa.gov website just once per week instead of multiple times per day. Stop updating on the website data on long-term breakouts, serology, underlying health conditions, and test Iowa assessments. Eventually, decommission coronavirus.iowa.gov altogether and move to a distribution format similar to the state public health department's weekly influenza report. While these moves may appear to make some sense because COVID-19 cases are down dramatically from the pandemic's winter peak, the state's decision to scale back its COVID data reporting also very well could be dangerous from a public health perspective, because while the marathon of working through this pandemic has reached its final stages, the race has not yet reached the finish line. Yes, COVID-19 cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are down, way down. Each of those averages is at minuscule levels, not seen since the very earliest days of the pandemic more than a year ago, according to state public health data. All of that is good news that should be celebrated. And because those numbers have plunged to such low levels, it's understandable that some may no longer see the need for round-the-clock live updates of the latest COVID data. However, the pandemic is not over, no matter how much we may believe it is or want it to be. First and foremost, not enough Iowans have received the COVID-19 vaccine. Just 61% of Iowa adults is fully vaccinated, the 22nd highest rate in the country, according to the New York Times analysis of federal data. Iowa is similarly in the middle of the pack for states' rates of adults who have received at least one shot of the vaccine. Those rates aren't high enough to truly check COVID-19 off Iowa's to-do list. Public health officials say 70% vaccination is generally a good target when dealing with something like the coronavirus. Iowa is not yet there. which makes the continued spread of COVID-19's Delta variant even more dangerous in Iowa. The variant spreads even faster, so with a large share of Iowa's population still unvaccinated, this is a precarious time here. Which makes it questionable time for the state to dial back how it informs the public about the latest data on how the virus is spreading throughout the state. Governor Kim Reynolds has consistently and throughout the pandemic has insisted, Governor Kim Reynolds has consistently said throughout the pandemic that she is proud of how the state was not as aggressive as others in its approach to mitigation tools like restricting businesses and public traffic or enacting face mask requirements. Reynolds boasts that she trusted Iowans to make the right decision for them. But by scaling back its COVID-19 data reporting, the state is now making it tougher for Iowans to make those informed decisions. The Delta variant is serious trouble. Not enough Iowans are vaccinated, and summer activities are in full swing. The finish line is in sight, but the rope has not yet been broken, and there are more twists and turns before this marathon is complete. It will be tragic if in the final miles, Iowa stumbles. That was the column submitted by Aaron Murphy of the Lee Des Moines Bureau. You are listening to the reading of the Daily Council Bluffs, the Daily Nonpareil, on this Monday, July 19th. This is reading, we're reading the Sunday edition of the Daily Nonpareil on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. And today we have five obituaries mentioned. First is Dean Eitman, that's spelled E-I-T-M-A-N-N. Dean Eitman, age 75, of Trainer, Iowa, passed away at the Methodist Hospital July 16th. Funeral service will be held, or has been held, at 10 a.m. at Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home on Monday, July 19th. The family received friends during the hour prior to the service, interment that afternoon in the Zion Congregational Church Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to Zion Congregational Church or Trainer Fire and Rescue for Dean Eitman. Barry G. Smith passed away July 14th. A private service is being held for Barry G. Smith, and the family is being attended by the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home and Crematory, Bayless Park Chapel of Council Bluffs. Raymond John Reinecke, age 71, passed away July 14th at Methodist Jeannie Edmondson Hospital. The Mass of recitation of the Divine Chaplet, Mercy Chaplet, will be Monday at 6 p.m., followed by visitation until 8 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Mass of Christian Burial Tuesday, 10 a.m., St. Patrick's Catholic Church, Neola. Interment, St. Columban's Cemetery, Weston, Iowa, followed by luncheon back at St. Patrick Church Social Hall. Memorials are suggested to St. Columbanus Cemetery Fund or St. Albert Schools for Raymond John Reinecke and the Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel is handling arrangements. Edward Frank Hornbeck, 88, passed away July 14th. Visitation at the Hoy Kilnoski Funeral Home from 5 to 7 p.m. with a prayer service at 7 p.m. on Monday, July 19th. Funeral service, St. Paul's Lutheran Church on Frank Street in Council Bluffs. Interment, with military honors will be Tuesday afternoon in the Magnolia, Iowa Cemetery. Memorials suggested to St. Paul Lutheran Church, and that would be for Edward Frank Hornbeck and Hoy Kilnowski Funeral Home and Crematory. Council Bluffs is handling arrangements. And finally, we have Dolores Marie Behrens Fisher, passed away July 14th at Bethany Heights in Council Bluffs, following a long and very healthy life. She died, it would have been her husband Khan's 100th birthday. Visitation with the family, Thursday, 5 to 7 p.m., St. Patrick's Catholic Church, Neola. Funeral Mass, Friday, 10:30 a.m., St. Patrick's Catholic Church, Neola. Interment, St. Patrick's Cemetery, Neola. Luncheon will follow in the parish hall. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests memorials to the St. Patrick's Church Foundation of Neola, St. Albert's School of Council Bluffs, the West Potawatomi 4-H Extension Trust Fund, the Neola or Underwood Fire and Rescue Squads, or a favorite charity of the person's choice. The family thanks the staff of Bethany Heights and Every Step Hospice for the wonderful care. That's for Dolores Marie Behrens Fisher, and the family is attended by Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home and Crematory, Bayless Park Chapel of Council Bluffs. And those are the five obituaries listed in today's paper. And now we turn to the sports page for some local prep stories. We have Abraham Lincoln softball shows grit in tough season, reported by Peter Huguenin. Abraham Lincoln softball faced about as much adversity as possible this season, with around half its starting lineup battling injuries at different points. A hand injury kept freshman Savannah Vanderwerf out for the season. A car wreck sidelined freshman Kelsey Nelson for multiple games after a car wreck. Sophomore pitcher Holly Hansen missed a week due to a hurt plant foot. Jasmine Villalobos missed over a week from an ankle injury suffered during basketball season, and freshman Teresa Clifton dealt with shoulder problems, and Jaden Hargrave led the state in hit by pitches with 29. Despite all the injuries, the Lynx still finished the season with a 16-20 record. I think we definitely had a good year considering everything we went through, head coach Ryan Koch said. The kids battled through it. It was a great group of kids to teach. We ended up being pretty darn successful considering the injuries. It would have been nice to see what we could have done had we been healthy. Girls stepped up that we were in different positions, and that they weren't used to playing. It was just a lot of fun coaching this group of kids. Koch said he believes Abraham Lincoln could have put together a 20-win season if not for the injuries and battled for a top two or three spot in the Missouri Valley Conference. Koch said he had a lot to say about his team, but said if he had to use one word to describe the Lynx, it would be grit. The kids just battled every day, he said. They were positive every day. I can't say enough how much fun it was coaching this group of kids and how much fun they had. Just that grit they showed every day. Even battling through those injuries, they wanted to play, but sometimes your body says no. As a coach, you can't ask for anything more out of kids than what they gave us this year. The Lynx still finished the season with many highlights, including some individuals achieving some personal goals. Jessica Vrenick just being the ultimate teammate for us, just stepping into pitch when she's never pitched before, doing it with a smile. Emma O'Neill did a really good job at catching after Kelsey's car accident. Kelsey Nelson had a wonderful year. Had it not been for that car accident, I bet she probably would have hit 400. Just the way the kids competed, it was just such a fun year. There was no, man, it's a tough year. It was just enjoyable going every day. Even the hurt kids showed up every day. It was just an amazing group of kids. They were so positive through everything. Another highlight was the Sioux City West doubleheader on June 30 when Nelson returned from her car accident. Koch said the team came together and played some of the best softball of the season. The kids rallied around Kelsey Nelson after the car accident. They just lifted her up, he said. That first game she came back and played with us, you could just feel the energy. It was probably our best two games of the year. It was just fun. Everyone was just excited to see her on the field. That was probably one of the best vibes I've ever had as coach. The future also appears bright for Abraham Lincoln, who only loses one senior, Jaden Larson. Jaden was a wonderful person to have on our team, Koch said. She wants to be a teacher when she grows up, and she's going to be the ultimate teacher when she graduates from college because she's always sticking up for the underdog, always picking people up when they're down. Just a wonderful human being to have in your program at any level. One of the nicest people I've ever been around. Abraham Lincoln will miss the presence of Larson, but returns leading hitters such as Rennick, Clifton, and Nelson, as well as key pitchers Hanson and Clifton. Rennick led the team with 48 hits, including two home runs. Clifton went 43 of 109 from the plate, and Nelson went 35 of 113. Hanson went 14-12 on the mound and recorded one save. She finished the season with 183 strikeouts. The injuries also allowed for multiple players to gain experience, which may lead to more competition for starting spots. I think it's really going to help our program, Koch said. Instead of a kid going into the season thinking they're going to start, now there's competition for some of the positions. It's going to bring out the best in the kids. The more they can compete with each other for those starting spots, the better it makes us. If we have to face that adversity again, these kids are going to be ready for it because they have the experience now. We'll work really hard on getting our pitchers healthy and developing some pitchers for years to come. And there's a color picture of Abraham Lincoln's Holly Hanson high-fiving head coach Ryan Koch after being substituted for a base runner on first during the seventh inning on July 8th. And a prep baseball story, Warriors roll past Lynx, reported by Austin Heinen. Class 4A number 9, Waukee defeated Abraham Lincoln baseball 10-0 after 5 complete innings on Friday night. After 4 first inning errors, the Warriors leaped out to an early 5-0 advantage after the first inning and would score another in the second to go up 6-0. Though the Lynx forced a scoreless third inning upon the Warriors, Waukee would end the game after scoring 2 runs in the fourth and fifth inning to end the game. Honestly, we did not come ready to play in this game, Helam said. We had a couple of good days of practice before the game, and when we were on the bus, the way up, Coach Reese and I were saying, we'll know how this game will go based on how we start the game. We had some mistakes and gave up 5 unearned runs instead of getting out of the inning where we probably shouldn't have given up any runs. Offensively, the Lynx were held to just 1 hit. Freshman Aiden Martin got the hit during the second inning. With the defeat, the Lynx will move from 2 seniors, Ricky Webster and Jaden Reese. Coach Helam was proud of each of their efforts this season and hopes next year's returnees will follow in their footsteps in terms of work ethic. After the game, I thanked each one of them for their commitment and hard work, Helam said. Hopefully, the freshmen and sophomores looked up to them in terms of how to go about putting in the work to be better. Jaden wasn't a vocal leader by any means, but he led by example. He'll do what you ask him to do, and he's ready to go to work all day, every day for you. Ricky didn't play as much as he may have liked, but he showed up every day. He had a great attitude every day, and he was cheering for whoever was on the field with us, win, lose, or draw. Waukee advances to the sub-state semifinal, where they will host Lewis Central on Monday. And now we take a look at the Week in Iowa page, a recap of news across the state from the past 7 days. We have a color picture of several police officers and other veterans surrounding a man in a wheelchair, and I'll read the caption. World War II vet stops in Iowa. Sidney Walton, a 102-year-old World War II vet, along with his son Paul Walton, at the Fairfield Inn in Davenport, talks with firefighters Michael Lintz and Lieutenant Steve Arthur from Station 8. Walton met Governor Kim Reynolds July 13 at the Capitol. Sidney Walton, one of the country's last World War II vets, is on a no-regrets tour of all 50 states and governors, raising awareness of our veterans who have sacrificed so much for our country. We have a couple of brief items, listings. The first is called Odds and Ends, Monopoly Busting. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack in Iowa announced federal plans to launch programs to increase competition in the meat processing industry and resiliency in the food supply chain. Council actions. Members of the Legislative Council approved pay raises of 1.1% to cover cost of living increases similar to other state workers for legislative employees. The panel also approved 8 interim study panels. Conditions improve. Drought conditions persist in some parts of Iowa, but substantial weekend rainstorms took the edge off concerns over developing corn and soybean crops, state officials said. And then we have 3 very brief items under the title The Water Cooler. Recruiting women. Linda Upmeyer, the first female speaker of the Iowa House and co-chairwoman of the Republican Party of Iowa, is launching a statewide Build the Bench campaign to recruit Republican women to run for office. Parks app. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources has developed an online mapping application to help visitors navigate trails in state parks by identifying trail names, trailheads, and acceptable trail uses. And roads site. Information on Iowa state and U.S. highways and interstates is now on one website, 511ia.org. 511ia, noncaps.org. The new version replaces a variety of formats. And those are the brief items that are listed in the Week in Iowa page. On the Lifestyles and Community page, we have a story reported by Sierra Hoeger, H-O-E-G-E-R, of the Gazette. Ely Creamery resumes tours of its farm-to-table production. Dan and Debbie's Creamery best-selling ice cream flavor was made as an accident. Josie Rosem, who oversees operations and is the daughter and owners of Dan and Debbie, notes that purple cow pie came about after her mother had forgotten a key ingredient in the ice cream flavor she was supposed to be crafting and instead grabbed ingredients from the freezer that would pair well together, birthing the vanilla ice cream with black raspberries and pie crust mixed in. It's just one of those that everyone's like, when is purple cow coming back? So that's just funny how that works out, Rosem said. It was a flavor that she wanted to toss, and we're like, no. Debbie and Dan tack Takes. I'm going to spell that T-A-K-E-S, probably spelled probably Takes. Began operating a dairy farm in rural Ely in 1997, expanding from an initial 30 cows to about 150. In 2013, the family bought a former lumber business on Ely's Main Street, and after a three-year renovation and thousands of dollars in investments in new equipment, opened Dan and Debbie's Creamery 5 years ago this month. The creamery sells milk, flavored cheese curds, and ice cream, all made in the building. Guided tours of the creamery were suspended in March 2020 after the COVID-19 pandemic spread to Iowa, but now the pandemic is waning. Tours of the production process are making a comeback. I think with everything going on, we're just ready to get people back in our store, continue educating, because that's such a big component of what we do, Rosam told the Cedar Rapids Gazette. A couple weeks ago, we rolled out the tours again. You know, obviously they can't be exactly like they were. We're trying to accommodate smaller groups just to help with spacing out and making people feel comfortable, but we're so excited to have all the people back in here and learning about what we're doing. Growing up on a dairy farm and assisting with the storefront for 5 years, Rosam has a personal connection with teaching visitors farm-to-table education and awareness. I think the reason why tours are so important for me is I want especially our youth to understand food just doesn't land on our table, Rosam said. I think there's such a huge disconnect between farmers and consumers that I really want to bridge the gap too, so that way people can trust their food again and know it's coming from a good place. While farm-to-table awareness is valuable, Rosam feels that older generations appreciate the nostalgia that comes with the tours. I think that age group of retirement age and older, the creamery takes them back to their childhood because a lot of people are used to cream-top milk, and a lot of people grew up on farms then, Rosam said. It sort of takes them back to their childhood, and that's really special too. While the tours take place only at the storefront at 1600 Main Street in Ely, expansions to the farm will make it possible for groups to visit it to gain the true farm-to-table experience. Last year, we started building a viewing area on our milking farm, so that way we can welcome tours, Rosam said. We're hoping to wrap up construction by the end of the year, and then we'll be able to make the tour component full circle by seeing the farm side and the production side. Tours occur 3 days a week at 10 a.m. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Admission cost is $4.50 with tax and includes a private creamery tour as well as a single scoop of ice cream. Small and medium-sized groups can schedule tours up to 2 months in advance. Since tours resumed in mid-June, spots have been filling fast. It's clear to me that people crave things to do right now, and if they get a learning opportunity and some ice cream at the same time, that's a pretty cool thing, Rosam said. Compared with a large dairy corporations that typically focuses on one facet of the dairy industry, Dan and Debbie's smaller scale process allows them to exercise control over products they produce and how they produce it. We have control long before the milk arrives here, basically what the cows eat, Rosam said. We grow all the crops on our family farm and harvest them ourselves. We tailor our cows' diets to really provide high quality flavor to our milk and our products. So every little step we do in the processing farm to table affects how it tastes. I also think a really unique thing is being a small organization and operation. We can get a little bit more creative and experiment with flavors. The local creamery rotates 30 to 40 ice cream flavors on a monthly basis, with seasonal flavors such as peppermint, pistachio, coconut cream, pie, and peaches and cream making appearances within the display case. And in conclusion, a brief look at the weather. It will be rather consistent in the mid to high 80s and the low in the mid to high 60s for the days of the coming week. Sunshine and beautiful for all of the week. And that does it for the reading of the Council Bluffs, the Daily Nonpareil, on this Monday, July 19th. On Mondays, we read from the Sunday edition of the paper. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.